We're going to look at another account of the negotiations conducted between Alan Dulles, who was head of the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency, and people like Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe, a representative of Walter Schellenberg, head of Amt 6 of the SS. That was basically the foreign affairs section of the SS. For this account of the origins of the Christian West concept, and by the way, the author never uses that particular term, but for this account of it, we're going to look at a book called American Swastika. That was authored by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M, published in hardcover by Doubleday and Company, and copyrighted 1985. Now, again, we're going to be looking at the negotiations conducted in Switzerland by Alan Dulles, himself an individual with many strong Nazi connections, and the people who were representatives of Walter Schellenberg's Amt 6 of the SS. And although, again, the concept Christian West is never specifically stated in this account, this is another account of the very same negotiations that we looked at from the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, subtitled, by the way, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. Charles Higham writes of these negotiations as follows. Alan Dulles was ideally chosen in the matter. Both he and his brother John Foster had extensive German connections. John Foster had been American representative at the Conference for the Regulation of Germany's Foreign Indebtedness, which had resulted in 1933 in the reduction of the Hitler regime of such indebtedness overseas. He had acted as an attorney for General Franco and as a director of the International Nickel Company, which was charged with trading with the enemy in World War II. He was a single-minded, an impassioned opponent of the Soviet Union, who was to play a crucial role in the post-war confrontations that provoked the Cold War. Alan Dulles was legal advisor to and a director of the Anglo-German Schroeder Banking Empire, S-C-H-R-O-E-D-E-R. The New York branch, which he represented, was a subsidiary of the London, Cologne, and Hamburg Schroeders. The Stein Bank of Cologne under Chairman Kurt von Schroeder was a chief financier of Himmler and of the hardcore SS inner circle. Even when he went to Switzerland in 1942, given carte blanche by the Vichy government, one of his law partners, Delano Andrews, took his place, thus securing the continued connection. By the way, that man's first name, capital D-E, capital L-A-N-O. The Swiss offshoot of the Schroeder Bank was one of Dulles' men, a director of the New York branch, Lada Mokarski, who conveniently was also U.S. vice consul in Zurich. That man's name, capital L-A-D-A, capital M-O-C-A-R-S-K-I. The American minister in Bern was Leland Harrison, who authorized shipments of oil of enemy origin through Switzerland in World War II, as well as allowing American oil companies to fuel the German and Hungarian embassies and consulates, and the Germans to retain Standard Oil barges on the Rhine, rentals of which were paid to New York for the duration. Dulles, when he arrived in Switzerland, made contact with the so-called opposition movement in Germany, including Schellenberg, Kaltenbrunner, Hjalmar Schacht, and others. Realizing that Hitler was losing the war, they sought to save their own necks and their financial alliances by making a separate peace. Since they opposed Hitler, who as a nationalist and patriot was determined to act against such internationalism, they were able to re-secure the fascist alliance for the indefinite future. And they could also join with Dulles in whitewashing this activity in the eyes of the public, which was bamboozled into thinking that they were idealists and potential forgers of a new Germany. Well, not idealists, perhaps, but they were potential forgers of a, quote, new, unquote, Germany. That is the, quote, new, unquote, Germany that T.H. Tettens wrote about in his book. Now, again, we're reviewing the generation of the Christian West concept by way of taking a look at some of the most powerful individuals in America, this industrial and financial elite, much of which was openly pro-fascist, this by way of understanding that the Galen Organization in no way was functioning in a vacuum, but rather the effect that it had was as a result of the way in which it interacted in the United States with very, very powerful American interests. Skipping down in Higham's account, now the Hohenlohe here is Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe, a representative of the SS. The meeting with Hohenlohe was as pleasant for Dulles as it was for the prince. Records of the encounter show that there were three conversations in all in Bern and Geneva, the last of them taking place on April 3rd. By the way, this is of 1943. The SS records are clearly authentic. Fortunately, I have obtained the documents from the files of a reliable source in England via Professor Klaus von Kemperer, professor of history at Smith College. There is, in my mind, no doubt of their authenticity. By the way, Klemperer, K-L-E-M-P-E-R-E-R, continuing. Dulles greeted Hohenlohe in a most friendly manner. The two men realized that they had met in Vienna in 1916 and again in New York in the 1920s. Dulles said he was happy to see Hohenlohe again after such a long time in order to exchange ideas, for Hohenlohe had such an astute mind as far as European affairs were concerned. Dulles said he was, quote, sick and tired of listening to stories of ruined politicians, emigrants, and prejudiced Jews, unquote. In his opinion, a peace should be achieved that all parties would be interested in maintaining. He said that the German state had to remain in existence to maintain order and begin reconstruction, that the Czech question was of small importance, but it was necessary to form a cordon sanitaire against Bolshevism and Pan-Slavism by, quote, enlarging Poland toward the east and maintaining Romania and a strong Hungary, unquote. He believed that planned industrial production after the war led by Germany's industries would be desirable. Under no circumstances were the Russians to be admitted to Romania or Asia Minor. The British might enter into negotiations with the Russians over spheres of interest, but the United States would like to maintain, quote, a modern and well-organized Europe as a high-income zone market and as a geopolitical factor, unquote. Dulles pressed ahead. He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return someday, and that there must be no toleration of a return of the Jewish power positions. This last sentence again. Now, bear in mind, this is Alan Dulles, and of course, these perceptions and the account presented here jibe very closely with the account presented by Burton Hirsch in The Old Boys. Dulles pressed ahead. He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return someday, and that there must be no toleration of a return of the Jewish power positions. He reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation, and foresaw the federal Germany that in fact took place. He said that Hitler would not be accepted as the leader of a restored Germany. He made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. Last sentence again, because it's a ripe one. He made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. This was Hitler's dream, of course, that the Jews would go to Madagascar and stay there. Dulles seems to have confused the clubland view of blacks and Jews. Dulles now proceeded to supply Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but after conquering Tunisia, would advance from Africa toward the Ploesti oil fields to cut off the German oil supplies. He said that it was likely the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure the advance in the Balkans. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe, top secret at the time, to one of Germany's agents, Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary rider that he had very good relations with the Vatican. He said American Catholics had a decisive voice in such matters. So again, notice Alan Dulles basically engaging in treason here, betraying American battle plans to an agent of a hostile foreign power. And this, again, my way of understanding that really re-emphasizing, because I've stressed it so many times in the past and so many different broadcasts, that fascism is not something that was alien to America. On the contrary, there were very powerful American interests that were pro-fascist, and with the Galen Organization introduced as our eyes and ears on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, the coming to power, the triumph of these fascist elements, in my opinion, was inevitable. And the formal ascension of fascism, the triumph of fascism in America, as I've stressed so many times, took place with the assassination of John Kennedy and the coming to power of the rollback or liberation milieu that we've looked at so often in this program. We're going to skip down still further in Haim's American Swastika, and we're going to take a look at the negotiations being conducted through the Vatican between Alan Dulles and Karl Wolff, Himmler's adjutant, an SS general and war criminal, and we're going to see the liaison function performed between the Vatican and Dulles and Wolf by Dr. Eugen Dollmann, D-O-L-L-M-A-N-N. He was the individual that we looked at a few weeks ago and that was serving as a roving representative of the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid and was very active with the German government. After having been arrested for war crimes or as a criminal, he received a slap on the wrist and was able to go on his way. Eugen Dollmann was in very close contact with the Nazi Party in exile and its representative in Germany, Dr. Werner Naumann, formerly the Secretary of State of Goebbels' propaganda ministry. Of the Vatican, Alan Dulles, the negotiations with Wolf, and Eugen Dollmann's role in this, Charles Higham writes as follows. Meanwhile, Dulles began separate negotiations with Waffen-SS General Karl Wolf, W-O-L-F-F, a former lieutenant in the Grand Duke of Hesse's Regiment of Life Guards who had risen rapidly through the ranks. He was now high in the Himmler hierarchy as leader of the military SS in Italy. Significantly, he drew checks for Himmler on the special SS account R, using the fund established by subsidiaries of American General Electric and Standard Oil. Wolf was thus a suitable contact for Dulles. He had an additional advantage. He had had an audience with Pope Pius XII in April of 1944 via his close friend, a historian and SS liaison officer, Dr. Eugen Dollmann. Not in the least fazed by the nature of his guest and go-between, the Pope was delighted with Wolf and said to him, quote, "How much misery might have been avoided if God had led you to me earlier. Allow me to send you on your dangerous road with my blessing on you and your family," unquote. The, quote, "dangerous road," unquote, to which the pontiff referred was Wolf's plan to set up a special and separate peace with Dulles. Ernst Kaltenbrunner, SS leader, was on the committee of discussion regarding these arrangements and indeed alleged at his trial at Nuremberg that he met Dulles in person. Wolf carried to Berlin a full account of his conversations with Dulles, conferring with Kaltenbrunner at his evacuation center, a farmhouse on the Autobahn near Berlin. Describing the contents of three separate conversations, Wolf said that he wanted, quote, "to build a bridge to the West," unquote, and that by handing over northern Italy with the condition that the German troops remain in power and retain their weapons, there would be set up, quote, "part of the proposed police force of the Western powers against Russia." Last sentence again. Describing the contents of three separate conversations, Wolf said that he wanted, quote, "to build a bridge to the West," unquote, and that by handing over northern Italy with the condition that the German troops remain in power and retain their weapons, there would be set up, quote, "part of the proposed police force of the Western powers against Russia," unquote. Dulles' real purpose in these meetings was to eliminate the communist Second Front in Italy. Stalin got wind of this and was appalled to discover that, in fact, as a result of the early negotiations, the Germans had been permitted to dispatch three divisions from Italy to the Eastern Front to attack Russia. Now, again, the Christian West concept, as well as the proposal by Wolf to allow the German troops in Italy to remain under arms, this did not take place because the military decline of the Third Reich had progressed to a point where it was simply not feasible for the interest in the United States that sought to ally with the Hitlerless Reich to do that during the war. As a result of their resistance to fascism, the Soviet Union had a lot of popularity with the troops of the Allied nations, as well as with it had won the admiration of the troops of the Allied nations, as well as many of the civilians in those countries. However, even in these negotiations, initially unsuccessful, we can see the formation of the Christian West concept, the alliance of a Hitlerless Reich with the Western nations. Obviously, that ultimately resulted in the regaining of Germany's lost territories, some economically, some territorially. It also, as we shall see, resulted in the triumph of fascism in the United States. Skipping down in Higham's account, by now, Dulles could dissemble no longer. Eisenhower was quite opposed to such finagling, and with the president dying, there was no chance of bamboozling the supreme commander on the pretext that Roosevelt authorized these arrangements. Wolf agreed to a German capitulation in Italy. At the same time, Dulles was able to suppress the communists. Oh, by the way, the communist Second Front in Italy refers to the fierce resistance by the Italian partisans against the Germans after Mussolini's collapse. It basically had the, offered the possibility of a communist triumph in Italy, and obviously that was of great alarm to Alan Dulles. Skipping down again into Haim's account, Wolf flew to Italy to sign the capitulation order, and Dolman, the go-between, appropriately lit a candle to the Madonna del Rosario. And bear in mind, that's the same Eugen Dolman who was serving as a roving representative of the Nazi Party in exile, very close to Dr. Werner Naumann. And recall also that in Radio Free America number 17, we went into the massive connections of the Vatican to international fascism. Pope Pius XII, formerly Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, had been serving as the papal nuncio in Munich and had channeled church funds to Hitler as early as 1919. Another point I want to emphasize, just as I have stressed that my observations concerning the resurrection of the Third Reich or the continuation of a Hitlerless Reich should in no way be interpreted as being anti-German or implying that all Germans are Nazis. By the same token, I don't want people to think that I'm implying that Catholics are fascists. One has to distinguish between the Vatican and the Catholic Church, just as one has to distinguish between the White House and the United States. They are obviously connected, and intimately so, but the policies of the White House and the outlook of the average American should never be confused. But Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, later Pope Pius XII, was openly pro-fascist, as were many of his successors. Now, of course, one of the principles of Marxism was a deep hostility to organized religion of any kind that aroused the fear and anger of the church, the Catholic Church, as well as other religious organizations, and led to the support of the Catholic Church and other religions for Adolf Hitler. Obviously not Judaism per se, but other religions were, to one extent or another, pro-fascist or at least not anti-fascist, because they saw fascism as an antidote to the threat of Marxism. And again, bear in mind one of the central concepts underlying Radio Free America number 37, the Third Reich and the Nazi Party's early realization that anti-communism, the fear of communism, could be used as a vehicle for conquering their non-communist neighbors and political opponents and economic rivals. What we're going to look at now will lead to what I had described earlier as a relatively speculative part of this broadcast. This will raise more questions than it answers, but the rise to power of the Christian right in the Republican Party in the 1980s and 1990s is a well-documented phenomenon. The Republican Convention in 1992 was noteworthy for the very strong influence of the Christian right on the Republican Party platform. Reactionary Christianity is nothing new. That it's been around for a long time. But the rise of the Christian right per se is one of the more significant phenomena of the political phenomena of the 1980s and 90s in the United States. What we're going to look at now is another aspect of the Third Reich's plans to go underground to avoid political defeat, even though military defeat was inevitable. And once again, we're going to turn to a very important anti-fascist book from 1944 by one of the most important of the anti-fascist writers of the period, a man named Kurt Ries, C-U-R-T-R-I-E-S-S. And we're, of course, going to turn to his book, The Nazis Go Underground, published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran & Company, and published in hardcover, copyrighted in 1944. And what we're going to look at now is the Third Reich's plan to avert defeat. Although it was going to be defeated militarily, they were seeking to avoid political defeat by allying with American religious fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists who were of pro-fascist or ultra-nationalist sympathies. Now, the extent to which Third Reich elements might have actually been able to hook up with some of the reactionary fundamentalists in this country remains speculation. Obviously, there have been contacts between reactionary fundamentalists in this country and domestic fascists, but it is fascinating to take a look at the Third Reich's plans for survival of military defeat in World War II and to see the long-term rise of the Christian right in the United States against the background of that. I myself am not aware of any direct contacts between or substantive and extensive direct contacts between representatives of the Third Reich and the Christian Right, but it would not surprise me if there were some. I think this is something that needs to be explored. There certainly are well-documented connections between domestic fascist elements, contemporary fascist elements, and the Christian Right, but again, it is very interesting to see the Third Reich's plan, one of the features of the Third Reich's plan to avert military defeat being their proposed hookup with fundamentalist Protestants in the United States. We're going to take a look at these contingency plans now. Now, as I read this section, take note of the name Gerald L.K. Smith, a very important individual and an individual that we're going to turn to later on in the discussion. Kurt Reese writes as follows in The Nazis Go Underground. Of the various groups in the United States that the Third Reich was proposing to ally with, Kurt Reese writes, the second group consists of numerous, quote, Gentile leagues, unquote, organized throughout the Midwest by isolationists who have gone on record as being in favor of a negotiated peace. The leagues are, of course, anti-Semitic. They want a, quote, Gentile peace, unquote. They ask their followers to, quote, buy Christian, unquote. They intend, quote, to halt growing Jewish power, unquote. The most important of them is the Gentile Cooperative Association in Chicago, which hopes to attain a membership of 5 million. This organization urges Gentiles, quote, to do all in their power to win the war first on the home front, unquote. Bear in mind, this is not unlike the sentiments being expressed by Alan Dulles, later on director of the CIA and a member of the Warren Commission. Continuing with Kurt Reese's account, it campaigns for, quote, the boosting of Gentile products, the perpetuation of Gentile business ethics and ownership, and the returning of Gentile servicemen back to their old jobs, unquote. The group is run by Eugene R. Flitcraft, L-I-F-L-I-T-C-R-A-F-T, active long before Pearl Harbor. Another anti-Semitic club is the Gentile League of Wisconsin, with headquarters in Watertown, headed by Arthur Friede, F-R-I-E-D-E, who asks his followers, quote, to combat those forces seeking to undermine the American way of life, unquote, the Jews, of course. Donald Shea, associate of many Japanese and German propagandists, has been reorganizing this Gentile League, which collaborates closely with the Mothers groups. Also of interest to Berlin, particularly in view of the coming underground fight of the Nazis, must be the fundamentalist Protestants, who have a considerable following in Michigan, Kansas, Colorado, and Minnesota. Again, also of interest to Berlin, particularly in view of the coming underground fight of the Nazis, must be the fundamentalist Protestants who have a considerable following in Michigan, Kansas, Colorado, and Minnesota. To be sure, some of the fundamentalists are among the most courageous fighters for democracy, but a great many of them are definitely pro-Hitler. Their reason for this stand is that fundamentalists do not believe in freedom of religion, and they do believe that the Jews should be punished because they killed Christ. They say that Hitler has been sent by God, quote, to save Christianity and destroy atheistic communism, unquote. Recall the Christian West concept. Resuming Reese's account, to many of them, Japan is the, quote, oriental outpost of Christianity, unquote, destined to save Asia from the danger of a, quote, communistic China, unquote. Most prominent among those pro-fascist fundamentalists is, of course, Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith. Almost equally prominent is Gerald B. Winrod, W-I-N-R-O-D, active long before Pearl Harbor, now under federal indictment for sedition, but still preaching, still running his Bible school, still editing his magazine, The Defender. He is also busy publicizing the speeches of congressmen who have been supporting indicted alleged seditionists. Winrod's friend, Harvey Springer, and a close associate of Gerald L.K. Smith, is pastor of the Baptist Tabernacle in Englewood, Colorado, teaches in various, quote, Bible schools, unquote, and edits the newspaper The Western Voice. Strongly anti-Semitic, anti-British, and pro-fascist, he and his newspaper have been praised by Senator Robert Rice Reynolds and Congressman John H. Folger, F-O-L-G-E-R. Then there is William D. Herstrom, H-E-R-R-S-T-R-O-M, fundamentalist minister in Minneapolis, an associate of Winrod, and editor of Bible News Flashes, which are opposed to Roosevelt, the British, the Russians, the Jews, and international cooperation. Hairstrom also wrote books of the same type. The Christian American Association of Houston, Texas must also be termed a fundamentalist organization. It is headed by Winrod's friend Harry Hodge of Beaumont, Texas, who knows Martin Dees well and is supposed to have interceded with the Dees Committee not to investigate Winrod. It's a rumor and it may not be true, but don't forget what you are reading here is what SS General Kaltenbrunner will as likely as not have in his files. Sure, Nazi files contain a lot of rumors. The Christian American Association is run by Vance Muse, M-U-S-E, and Louis Valentine Ulrey, U-L-R-E-Y, demands anti-strike legislation. Last sentence again. The Christian American Association is run by Vance Muse and Louis Valentine Ulrey and demands anti-strike legislation. Englewood, Colorado is the home of a national organization of Christian youth, which in the beginning of 1944 was still by way of being established. It will be run by Kenneth O. Goff, G-O-F-F, who was a communist till 1939, but according to his own statement, quote, became a Christian, unquote, when the Communist Party ordered him to Moscow and asked him to leave his wife at home. Sometime in 1943, he joined the fundamentalists. He occasionally collaborated with Gerald L. K. Smith, addressed Chicago Citizens USA Committee, combats the Jews, our government, and our allies. He is backed by Harvey Springer, Winrod's friend. Other fundamentalists who have been fighting the Jews, the administration, quote, communism, unquote, or simply, quote, modernism, unquote, are Harry Grube, G-R-U-B-E, of Mobile, Alabama, R.M. Parr, P-A-R-R, of Detroit, Michigan, Glenn Smith, of Palmer Lake, Colorado, S.J. Greer of Denver, G-R-E-E-A-R, Colorado, of course, C.K. Peterson of Phoenix, Arizona, Dennis Brown of Greeley, Colorado, and W.C. Love of Hazel Park, Michigan. So again, one of the Third Reich's contingency plans to survive military defeat in World War II was to hook up with American Christian fundamentalists, those of reactionary enough sentiments to make them potential political allies of the Third Reich. Many of them, obviously, were espousing views very similar to those of Adolf Hitler. And again, notice the similarity between Alan Dulles' views and the views of some of these projected allies of a survived Reich. And again, bear in mind the Christian West concept, because obviously the notion of Christian West relates directly to the opposition on the part of fundamentalist religious people to the atheism of Marxism. Returning again to American Swastika by Charles Higham, now bear in mind the role of the Hunt interests in this rollback or liberation milieu. Bear in mind the numerous connections between the Hunts and elements that were involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, whether or not the Hunts themselves were involved. Many people believe so. There's never been anything to absolutely link them to the assassinations, but they sure are deeply involved with the milieu that was involved with the assassinations and may very well have been involved themselves. Now, we're going to take a look now at the evolution of H.L. Hunt's political machinations as a religious organization, and we're going to take a look at H.L. Hunt's distribution of the material being generated by people like Gerald L.K. Smith, who we looked at in the Nazis Go Underground as one of the potential allies of a resurrected Reich. Again, to American Swastika by Charles Higham of H.L. Hunt, his resurrection of much of the fascist propaganda of the 1940s, and his distribution of the material of among others, Gerald L.K. Smith, Higham writes as follows. Speaking of domestic fascist organizations, the organizations proliferated in the 1950s to a degree almost inconceivable, even in the careless rapture of the early 1940s. There was the Congress of Freedom, not to be confused with the more intellectually respectable CIA-connected Congress for Cultural Freedom, and the aggressive group headed by Dan Smoot of Dallas, a self-styled authority on every aspect of communism, whose favorite targets were Ed Murrow, Jack Kennedy, and needless to say, Eleanor Roosevelt. There was H.L. Hunt, worth approximately $3 billion, with an income of $50 million a year, whose Lifeline Foundation received a postal subsidy and a tax exemption as a religious organization. That last sentence again. There was H.L. Hunt, worth approximately $3 billion with an income of $50 million a year, whose Lifeline Foundation received a postal subsidy and a tax exemption as a religious organization. Lifeline had 300 radio stations and 55 television stations emitting a constant stream of Nazified propaganda in collaboration with Dan Smoot, Merwin K. Hart, and Gerald Smith. The John Birch Society climbed on the bandwagon. Now, bear in mind again that Nelson Bunker Hunt of the Hunt family was a part of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, a German-based intelligence network headed by, at one time or another, former SS officer Theodor Oberländer, a key player in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a key Galen operative, the former West German minister for Ex-Belle. Dan Smoot was among the individuals who hooked up with Dr. Walter Becker, one of the key proponents of returning the Volksdeutsche and the Sudeten Germans to their homeland. We took a look at Dr. Walter Becker's profound connections in the United States last week. And bear in mind, again, that we're looking at people like the Hunts hooking up with German fascists who were themselves operating on behalf of a resurrected Reich in Germany, and we see people like H.L. Hunt distributing the material of people like Gerald L.K. Smith, an individual who was not only funded by Henry Ford, but was actually receiving funding and instructions and propaganda material from a German espionage agents functioning as diplomats in the United States, particularly a fellow named von Geinath, G-E-I-N-A-T-H, and Hans Luther, L-U-T-H-E-R. We took a look at that in our Aryan Nation series, specifically in Radio Free America number 10. Gerald L.K. Smith ultimately had two proteges named Wesley Swift and Colonel William Potter Gale, and they in turn gave rise to the modern Aryan Nations group, which is headquartered in Hayden Lake, Idaho. And this, again, by the way of looking at the alliances between reactionary Americans and representatives of this resurrected Reich, because to a certain extent at least, the Hunt family's relationship with people like Gerald L.K. Smith, a domestic fascist, and people like Theodor Oberländer, a German fascist, obviously an SS veteran, the former head of the SS Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall that liquidated the Jewish population of Lvov or Lemberg in the Ukraine. What we're looking at is an alliance of German and American reactionaries, which to a considerable extent could be said to constitute the fulfillment of what was projected by Kurt Ries in 1944, namely a hookup by a resurrected Reich with American fundamentalists. The one they most looked to hook up with, according to Kurt Ries, was Gerald L.K. Smith. And we've seen the strong connections here. We've taken a look at the accessing by H.L. Hunt's Lifeline Foundation, tax-exempt as a religious organization, of the poison of, among others, Gerald L.K. Smith. To a certain extent, at least, this Hunt relationship, not only with Gerald L.K. Smith, but the Nelson Bunker Hunt participation of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, and again, bear in mind the Christian West concept, this could be said to represent the fulfillment of what the Kurt Ries projected in 1944 in the Nazis Go Underground. Now again, this line of inquiry raises many more questions than it answers. One wonders to what extent Third Reich alumni have indeed hooked up with the Christian right in the United States. There certainly are connections between domestic American fascists and the Christian right. I have not personally seen anything in the literature about the connections between the Third Reich and some of these people beyond what I've already touched on, but I think that's an area that needs to be thoroughly explored, because it may very well be a profound connection, and to a certain extent at least, the rise of the Christian right in this country could be said to might represent the ultimate fulfillment of what the Third Reich was looking to do inside of the United States. One of the organizations that we've looked at in connection with the destabilization of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, is of course the Free Congress Foundation, an organization deeply connected with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations that was formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943. We're going to return again to covert action information bulletin number 35 from the fall of 1990, and we're going to return again to an article called The Free Congress Foundation Goes East by Russ Bellant, B-E-L-L-A-N-T, and Lewis Wolf, W-O-L-F. Wolf is the author, one of the editors of Covert Action Information Bulletin. And what we're going to take a look at here is the Free Congress Foundation. Now, we've taken a look at its profound connections with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations before. What we're going to look at here are the connections of the Free Congress Foundation and people associated with it with domestic American fascists such as the Ku Klux Klan. And we're also going to take a look at the strong connections between the Free Congress Foundation and the religious right in the United States. Also, by the way, we're going to take a look at connections between the Free Congress Foundation and reactionary Catholic institutions in the U.S. as well. Bellant and Wolf write as follows in CAIB number 35. The Free Congress Foundation was founded in 1974 by Paul Weyrich as the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. Weyrich, who had started the Heritage Foundation the year before, was heavily funded by the Coors family for both organizations. Weyrich has kept one foot in the right wing of the Republican Party while dallying with the racist right and the extreme Christian right. Last sentence again. Weyrich has kept one foot in the right wing of the Republican Party while dallying with the racist right and the extreme Christian right. In 1976, for instance, he and a handful of other new rightists, William Rusher, Morton Blackwell, and Richard Viguerie, attempted to take over the segregationist American Independent Party, or AIP, formed by George Wallace in 1968. The AIP was an amalgam of Ku Klux Klan and John Birch Society elements. In 1982, Weyrich published an essay in which he stated, quote, "Culturally destructive government policies, racial hiring quotas, and busing come to mind as examples, are to the new right more immediately important in the realm of action since the damage they can do is enormous and practically irremediable." Unquote. This apparent defense of, quote, white culture, unquote, is dangerously close to theories advocated by white supremacists today. Now, in addition to apparent white supremacist connections or actual white supremacist connections and beliefs on the part of Paul Weyrich, and by the way, bear in mind also, in addition to the Free Congress Foundation's connections to the racist right, bear in mind the dalliance of Weyrich and company with the American Independent Party and through that the Ku Klux Klan. We're going to take a look at their involvement with not only reactionary Catholic elements, but also with the Christian right. I also think, as we notice the various, quote, centers, unquote, of the Free Congress Foundation, a certain structural similarity to the organization that the Nazi Party and German government were undergoing in the Third Reich in preparation for continuing underground activities. Skipping down in Bellant's and Wolf's article, the Free Congress Foundation is generally identified with the, quote, secular, unquote, new right rather than the, quote, religious, unquote, new right, but in fact it melds both currents of rightist activity. Although structurally one organization, FCF could be seen as a dozen semi-independent groups housed in one office complex and with one boss. The FCF divides many of its activities into, quote, centers, unquote. They are centers for government and politics, law and democracy, cultural conservatism, state policy, conservative governance, child and family policy, foreign policy, transportation policy, Catholic policy, and the new freedom and democracy. Again, this last paragraph, the FCF divides many of its activities into, quote, centers, unquote. There are centers for government and politics, law and democracy, cultural conservatism, state policy, conservative governance, child and family policy, foreign policy, transportation policy, Catholic policy, and the new freedom and democracy. In the FCF's 1988 annual report, the Center for Catholic Policy states, quote, "The public policy influence and activity of the Catholic Church in America often runs counter to the interests of Catholic laity. The Center for Catholic Policy seeks to instruct conservative Catholic laity how to become influential in shaping public policy stands taken by the Church," unquote. The FCF report says that a, quote, "network of some 40 national Catholic organizations, institutions, and publications which share a generally conservative viewpoint," unquote, was formed by FCF in January of 1988 and called the Siena Group. That's capital S-I-E-N-A. According to the FCF, Among the top priorities of the Siena Group in 1988 was mobilizing opposition to a U.S. Catholic Conference statement on AIDS policy, which was favorable to the objectives of the gay and lesbian rights movement. Siena Group participants convinced the bishops to set aside the AIDS document. So, again, with the Free Congress Foundation, as pointed out here by Bland and Wolf, we're looking at an organization with connections to the domestic American fascists, such as the Ku Klux Klan. We're looking at an organization that has connections to international fascists, such as the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Many of those, of course, were brought into the U.S. through the Galen Organization. We're talking about an organization that has links to the Christian extreme right, as well as to the Catholic extreme right, in which, in certain respects at least, bears a certain rough similarity to the organization of the Nazi Party and the German government as the Third Reich was preparing to go underground. And again, I refer people to the discussion of that coming from Kurt Reese's book that we did in weeks past. And again, I want to emphasize that this particular part of the broadcast is one which will certainly raise many more questions than it answers, but one has to wonder, I think, in light of the development of the Christian far right in this country and its triumph in the Republican Party, at least for the time being, one has to wonder to what extent the Nazi goal of hooking up with Christian fundamentalists of fascist sympathies, where the Third Reich goal may perhaps have been realized. And again, we've looked at that projection from Kurt Reese in 1944. I wonder to what extent Kurt Reese was accurately forecasting what was to take place. What we're going to look at next is a section of a book that we've used before. In fact, we did this in radio, we covered this in Radio Free America program number 3. Oh, by the way, before I move on to this particular item, bear in mind Paul Weyrich's connections to Franz Josef Strauss, the German defense minister, one of the most significant reactionaries in the quote new unquote Germany, an individual directly connected to the Heusinger Galen resurrected German general staff and defense ministry, because Weyrich was very close to him as well. We're going to turn now to a book called Galen, Spy of the Century, obviously about Reinhard Galen. The book was authored by E.H. Cookridge, C-O-O-K-R-I-D-G-E. It's a book we've used extensively in the past. I'm going to read now from the Pyramid softcover edition, copyright 1973. It was published in hardcover by Random House and copyrighted 1971. Now, of the lifelong Third Reich intelligencer and anti-Soviet crusader, Reinhard Galen, a very private individual who did not like to give interviews, who did not like to be photographed, we're going to take a look at what Reinhard Galen chose to do after his formal retirement from the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the final incarnation of Fremde Heere Ost, the Third Reich's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization.